Welcome to Farming Aotearoa with agricultural journalist Peter Burke. Hi folks, and welcome to another edition of Farming Aotearoa for 2025, sponsored by Rural News, the newspaper that gets the top stories to farmers every week. And once again, we have agricultural journalist Peter Burke, who works for Rural News, and he is with me in the studio to bring us up to date on what's been happening in the past month. Well, A, I cannot believe it's been a month, but time does seem to fly. Pete, what has been happening? One of the main talking points?
Well, I found the same thing. I sort of last night thought, didn't realise I had to do this program. And I'd already packed my bags ready for golf. And then suddenly at 10 o'clock, I had to write a script, which was interesting. So that put paid to my reading last night. But that's another issue. No, it's been a very full-on month, a lot happening in the farming sector. As you sort of get at this time of the year, it's sort of been, it is a time when things build up a bit. And it's coming to the end of autumn now, into winter, and for me the big story has been the drought in coastal Taranaki, and not all of Taranaki, just coastal Taranaki. So we're talking around the coast areas, around Manaia, around there. And I had a brainstorm one morning about 3 o'clock to say, I think I'll go to Manaia tomorrow morning, and I went to Manaia for 4 hours up and down to have a look at a farm, and it was really eye-opening because I heard a lot about what was going on there. Now, just be clear, coastal areas, the inland areas, interestingly enough, are not affected. So just to put the context of weather patterns in play, we've had a lot of northeasterly winds, and they come in, they hit the mountain, and it deflects the rain back into the inland areas. So you're getting places like Inglewood, Stratford, all those places are quite doing very well, thank you very much. But the rain is not getting out to the coastal areas around that sort of Hawera North area.
Okay.
So the place I went to was a farmer up in Manaia, and he told me that was the driest he's ever had in 50 years. There it is, there, a picture of him there.
He showed me a picture, and yeah, it looks like basically he should be moving to Australia with that sort of
The other thing that they had there was that he and a lot of other farmers had, that not only did they not get much rain, and they've been getting spot that's better now, but when I went there first, they had not only the paddocks were dry, but also they had grass grub. So the grass grub ate up the paddocks. So you had the situation where he and many others had to literally re-sow all their paddocks. And he was in the process of doing it. And the grass was starting to come through. It looked like a tinge of green. What he said to me was he had spent $200,000 on buying supplementary feed to keep his cows going for the autumn period.
That's mad.
He'd culled early. Oh. He'd been one of those that had, you know, proactively decided to do it. And in January he went once a day. So in other words, he's really just keeping the minimum amount of milk flow going to keep his cows in condition so that when they calve in July, August, they're in good condition. And in fact, it was wonderful to see his animals. They were in beautiful condition. He'd spent a lot of money. His answer was, it's cost me a lot, but if I didn't do it, it would cost me even more next season.
Right.
And the thing that, one of the things that's come through is that the reason that he and others have survived quite well is that the payout for dairy farmers is $10 per kilogram of milk solids, which means it's a good price. So normally, and you'd expect them to be making a profit in this time of the year, and a lot of farmers will have made a profit. For some of these guys in Taranaki, they will just about break even. He said, we'll just be over the break even mark. So in other words, all this profit which he would have had probably is just gone. But the one thing I admire about dairy farmers is they have to think about the next season. So if they milk their cows on and milk them hard, the cow condition would drop. Calving may be a failure. They might have two bad years instead of one bad year. And one guy told me once that I expect to get, out of 5 years, I expect to get two good seasons and the rest, some will be bad, some will be, you know, barely break even. I guess it's just the nature of the weather, the nature of all the other things that happen around it. But to go out on a farm and see some of those people, what they're doing, is quite staggering. And this guy, Richard Walker, was really interesting, taking me through what was happening there. And it was quite a very sobering experience just to see and to hear the way he was so positive about, look, you know, look, this is really hard for these guys.
Yeah.
For some, it's going to be even worse. What he did, and there was a vet up there called Stephen Hopkinson, he got farmers together early on and said, look, this is going to be a bad season, guys. Get your act together, be proactive, don't leave it, because I don't think it's going to work right. And many of them did do that. Therefore, they've survived by the skin of their chinny-chin-chin, but they've survived. Others won't have. What they're saying is there were just truckloads of supplement coming in them all over the place to fill the next. And if I went to his place, and the stacks of baleage are horrendous. You know, you could just about run just about a length of a rugby field.
Gee.
All the bits, but he survived. Just talking a couple of days ago to the farmers up in there, the grass is greener. It's growing now, because the good news is that the soil moisture has been quite high. It's good. The soil temperatures have been good.
Yeah.
Soil moisture is poor. They reckon it'll be 2 years before the aquifer comes back to what it should be. But soil temperatures have been good. There's been enough rain there to get the grass to grow. And they're hoping that they traditionally in Taranaki get a flush of grass in May. And they're hoping that some of these farmers who are really badly hit will be able to take a cut of silage off that grass. And because at the moment the feed supplements are very, very hard to get. They're saying they can't get any from Manawatu, which they normally do. They can't get any from Hawke's Bay, which they normally do. And, you know, one guy said to me the other day, well, if you haven't got supplements by now, you're up the creek, sort of. So it's going to be hard. And I know the Rural Support Trust are going out there at the moment trying to get put word out to other parts of the country to see what feed's available. They're looking at the Wairarapa. I was talking to the Rural Support Coordinator from Taranaki just the other day, and she was telling me that they're doing their best. The one thing that's a problem in Taranaki at the moment, and it's a problem for any situation like this, is the contract milkers, because they are totally reliant on the payout. Now, if they've culled the cows, they've gone in early, they stop milking, they're not getting any money. There's no wages there at all. And there's a general worry that contract milkers will be badly affected. And the Rural Support Trust is saying to me, well, we expect as things move on the next month or so, or next few weeks, these people are going to start to come forward and see how can we get some help from MSD, how can we get help to get us through for the next few months, because the next paycheck won't be until the cows start to produce milk again, which might be August, September. And that's a real worry. It's a particular worry in coastal Taranaki. It's been a worry in other parts of the country too, but specifically in Taranaki. So, yeah, I know I've raved on about the drought, but it is the big story at the moment in that area. It is big for dairy farmers. And you've got a feel for these guys and really admire their tenacity, their willingness to get up and go and do things. And, you know, as I said, we're only saved by the fact that we got a $10 payout this year. That's really what's, you know, got us there and got us over the line, and that's been a big issue here.
So have you got some good news for us? Well, with regards to, you've got an appointment that you wanted to talk
about?
Yes,
I was talking about the appointment of Dr. John Roach. He's now been made the Prime Minister's Chief Science Advisor. Now, I know John personally very well. He's a great guy. He's a great communicator. He's a very good scientist, and he works for the Ministry for Primary Industries, and he is their chief science advisor as well. He's going to retain that role because the government role is only a part-time role. I've heard a few grizzles from other scientists, and I just get a bit, and Greenpeace, I'm sorry, I'm probably the Greenpeace listening to me, but too bad, grizzling about a person who's got a dairy background being in that role. Well, the answer is also just remember that most of our exports, the vast majority of our income exports, come from dairying anyway. But John is above that. I know him well enough to know that he knows a lot. He's a great communicator of science, and he will do the right thing for New Zealand. And I think it's great, for the first time we're seeing the primary sector having a person right next to the Prime Minister to put their case, because he will be up with the play. Given that he's still working for the Ministry for Primary Industries, he'll be getting feedback from farmers and his other staff around the country. He will know what's going on. He won't take rubbish from people. He will listen to people carefully and measured, and he will be measured in his approach. So I was just quite delighted to see that John picked up that job, and it's a credit. It's taken a long time to do it. There'd been about a year gap between the last science advisor and John, but I suppose the answer is it was worth waiting for, because at least there was someone there now who I think will do a good job. There's others on. They've also set up an advisory panel, which is not only John, there's other people there. There's a bit of a complaint about the fact that some of these people have got dairying in them. Well, one of them is from Fonterra, that's true. But there's another person, Graham Pygott, who's the founder of Halter, which is a company that produces those electronic cold things that go on cows to measure their where they're doing, all that sort of thing. And I got a little bit niggly and thinking, well, come on, you know, okay, you've had it your own way for quite a while. Is it wrong that the main earner of exports and export dollars for New Zealand suddenly gets a bit of a say in this world? Is it really too hard to ask that? And I think that's a good point. So I know I've raved on about him, but I think that Roach is a great guy, great person, and will do a great job for New Zealand. So there we go.
Okay, so it's been a year since the EU-NZ Free Trade Agreement. What's happened?
So that was one of the last really comprehensive free trade agreements that New Zealand has negotiated, and we've had other sort of mini ones since then. But this was a very long-awaited one, and it's now a year since it was it came into force, as they say. In other words, it happened. And there was a big celebration in Wellington at the Beehive, a function, Europe Day, which happened to coincide with the day the free trade agreement was signed. And what it has done for New Zealand is that, you know, not everyone was happy with that, of course. There was people who said we should have got better access for dairy. Why didn't we get this? Why didn't we get that? Well, okay. You've got to eat dead rats in this business, to be realistic. Everything's not going to be perfect. But what we've seen is that the free trade agreement so far has delivered an incredible amount of extra money for New Zealand, about $1 billion. And the big winners in this have been lamb for kiwi fruit. I think seafood's also there. I think honey's also there as well. And it's starting to show that we are getting better access than we've had. The EU are also benefiting. They're getting access for their things into New Zealand, which is important. And we are seeing a much better, stronger relationship with that part of the world. It's a big, you know, 27 countries there. It's a big operation. So for New Zealand to have that deal is good. And so that was a celebration. And we're seeing in that the EU itself are very proud of what's happening. The EU ambassador to New Zealand, Lawrence Meredith, he sees it as being, you know, great things happening from it, New Zealand getting access, but also them getting a good deal as well. And to that extent, they're going to organise a big business summit at the end of the year. It'll be hosted by Todd McClay, the Minister for Agriculture and Trade, but the EU are doing it, and they're bringing all their top business people to New Zealand. And they'll be talking about what can they do in New Zealand, and they're interested obviously in providing things like machinery, infrastructure things. So there's a benefit in that coming through, and that's going to be a big thing, and that's part of it. I think FTAs, while they talk about trade, they also talk about, there's also a political element to that too. And it's well known, of course, that New Zealand does have a strong view on Ukraine, and the EU does that too, obviously, very strongly. The EU is very strongly committed to what we call rules-based trade. In other words, not just power-based trade, but to rule, and we'll talk about the rules-based trade in a minute. So there's lots of commonality things there. So we've now got a free trade agreement with the UK and with Europe, and that's really set us up very nicely, I think, in those areas. It's formalised what was there. It's built on. It'll be built on over the years. As time goes by, there'll be more options for negotiation. Some of the tariffs will be lifted over a period of time, as they are. That's generally the way they do it. You don't get everything in the same rush. You do get these things taking time. So that's the big thing. So a great night out there, and good to see how the free trade agreement was put together, and to see it celebrated in a way, and seeing people, I think, happier now. Everyone was a bit nervous about it at the start, but it's a very comprehensive one. It's got a big chapter in there for Māori as well. There's a lot of environmental things there. It's not just about selling a few widgets here and there. It's a really comprehensive political trade, a whole lot of other things in it as well, which is great.
Okay, I understand that you've been having a chit chat to Winston Peters.
Yeah, I've never actually sat down with Winston.
This surprises me that you haven't.
No, I've talked to him briefly, but he said, he asked me where I'd been, and I said, well, you've got a few months on me, but not a lot. I'm catching up with you, which I had to say to him. But, you know, it was a case of a couple of old guys sitting around and laughing and carrying on a few jokes and telling a few things that I can't repeat on the air about life. But it was nice. He was a very pleasant individual. And I've got a lot of time for him in a sense of, I think his things like the decorum of Parliament is really important. I think we lose a lot by seeing people appearing in beach clothes virtually in Parliament. And I don't, that isn't right to me. And he's, if you look at him, he's very sartorial in his dress. I actually retired as well and thought, right, I'm going to be there and be part of it too. But the reason for the talk was he'd spoken at a breakfast that I went to a few days beforehand. It was a Chatham House rule, so I couldn't report anything. And I thought what he said had made a lot of sense. And I just went up to his press sec and said, any chance of talking to him? And by the time I got home from Wellington, there was an invitation to come and see him for half an hour on Monday, which I did. I had half an hour with him. The message he's got is, which not everyone will agree with, and I accept there's people, I'm not going to try and give a view of this, but some people say that he is kowtowing to the US by not calling out Donald Trump, by not calling out Israel, etc., etc., etc. What Peters is saying, and there is merit in it, is that these things will settle down in some time. There is no point in reacting to everything that's said, because you're only escalating the problem or making it worse. And his view is to say, let's see what happens. Let's be measured in our approach. Let's take a line where we're going to be diplomatic. I think he's talking about, you know, we need to be super aware, sensitive, alert, and hold our counsel. And that's what he's doing. He's being very, very not pleasing everyone, you know. He describes the situation as like walking on glass, because there is things. Donald Trump could easily be upset by something quite innocuous. And I think we saw that when he sacked Phil Goff in that historic moment when Goff made some remarks in London. Now, whether you agree with that or not, the fact is that that was part of this whole process of him making sure that diplomacy is carried out, not personal opinions, not personal attacks. And a couple of comments he made I think were very valid. He said something like, New Zealand should be judged on the strength of its argument, not on its military power. And small nations matter were two key things that I took out of this whole discussion, even at the breakfast. And that goes back a long way, that idea, because as he pointed out to me, most of the nations in the world are small anyway. There's not too many big powers. Mm. And therefore, what he's saying also is that we're seeing a shift at the moment, which he's unhappy with, which is from what we call rules-based trade, in other words, working through the protocols of the World Trade Organization and other agreements, to power, people just exerting power because they have real power in terms of military might or whatever it might be. And you can guess who he's talking about in that sense.
I think so, yes.
And I won't say it because I'm not going to get offside with anyone, which is a surprise. He's also saying, and I thought was a very interesting comment, was that New Zealand, when they came to power, when the coalition came to power in 23, they believed that New Zealand had not been keeping up the contacts with overseas countries in the way they should have been. Now, there was COVID in the middle of that, but there was also a minister who didn't want to travel, and for whatever reason, health, whatever it was. But nonetheless, if you look at Winston nowadays and you look at, say, Todd McClay, those two guys are on the road almost every week somewhere. And what he's saying is that we need to do that all the time. This there's a bit of history in this for me, because I can go back to the 70s and 80s when I was working for Radio New Zealand. And we had for a number of years, we had a flurry of prime ministers and ministers of agriculture and trade going to all parts of the world, again, to secure access for our primary products. And the relationships are very important. You know, there's that very famous sales and marketing slogan that says, you can't make a sale until you have a relationship. And that's a truism. It's the same in journalism, actually, believe it or not. I can't get stories out of people unless we have a relationship of some sort. And his his view is that we've got to go and build those. We've got to get to know not only our counterparts in the officials line, at the diplomatic line, but also get out in the field a bit, get out and meet farmers as well in India and other places in the world, so that they get a first-hand message of where we're coming from, and that we shouldn't be too afraid of what's coming. He made a comment about India, which is interesting. India is always on the radar. Where, you know, will we sell to India? What's the story? And his comment was around, we probably will never sell a pint of milk to India, but India is the biggest producer of milk in the world, but they've got to increase their milk production, and with the cows they've got, they won't be able to do it. So can New Zealand help them with providing better livestock to increase their milk? And that's how we might get into that market. We did that many years ago up in Asia, where we sold Friesian Sahiwal cows up into Thailand and places like that. And that was how we got into those markets, simply by, I don't say just going through the back door, you might put it in other words, but it was a very good way of doing it. And so Winston's view, I think, is spot on. I've written a piece which said, you know, the Winston way is a good way, because I think what he's saying is right. If we started to react to everything that Donald Trump said or someone else said, we get to a war of words. And really, at the end of it all, we've got to come back and negotiate. And the US market is very important in New Zealand. It's our second biggest market for meat. It's a very profitable one now. The comment was made that, you know, in the last year or so, prices for our meat have gone up by something like 35%, so it's good value in that. So why try to have a fight? And his view is, and time will tell, that things will calm down in time and it'll be okay. We'll get there. Don't worry too much. So that's the Winston one. I enjoyed talking to him, actually. I thought it was very, we had a lot of fun, but then again, probably we come from the same generation, virtually, and baby boomers, we've got something in common. He said something I thought was interesting. People will hate me for this. The baby boomers think that being on time is being 5 minutes early. Others think that being on time is being on time is late. And I agree with that, but that's just me being, you know, what I am.
All right, forests versus farms.
There's a big issue still around overseas people coming in and buying up farms for forestry.
So it's forestry rather than forests.
It's forestry.
We're not talking about native forests here.
This is about highly productive, or productive land that's currently being used for livestock, being sold to overseas people to grow pine on to get carbon credits, etc., etc., etc. And as I go around the country, and I've been around it a lot in the last 2 months or so, you do see land which you think, really, that should still be running sheep on it.
Can I stop you there? I know we haven't got much time, but why does it have to be pine? Do they chop it down again?
Well, it's...
Because if you're getting a carbon credit, what's the point?
Well,
they're releasing the carbon again.
They're cheap to grow, and they're easy to grow, and natives take longer to grow, so why'd you do it? You know, it's the old cheapo type way of doing it. Sadly, I mean, I don't like
just someone ticking a box, isn't it?
It is, really, and to be fair, there's a strong argument that says that forestry does not do a lot to support rural communities.
And they don't do much for the environment either.
No, they don't. And okay, so you plant trees. There's people coming to do that. They come in from outside, do it. Then they come in and trim them. That's them outside.
Right.
Whereas if you have livestock on the place, on that farm, there are people in that community earning money. They keep the schools, the hospitals, all those things going. And I am a little bit anti this personally. I'll stick my neck out here and say it, because I don't think it helps the rural communities at all by having... There is places for forestry, don't get me wrong, but there are places for it. Not just anywhere is a place for it. And the government says they've got some rules that are in place, but they're still ticking through. There's still some of the long-term applications are still coming through. And we saw two farms recently up in Hawke's Bay being sold or being approved by the Overseas Investment Organisation and being converted to forestry, which...
Just better off doing planning, urban planning, and planting native forests rather than...
Native forests, but even so, I think we can get... I think the tree planting is okay, but what we're trying to do, I believe, is to try and give... put numbers into rural communities, so there's shopkeepers. You keep a community going, and that's what Europe is about too. Little communities, villages. And
you don't have to wipe out a whole field.
No, you don't, no.
Yes.
So,
no, I think they really need to look at that. That just looks silly.
Yeah, it does, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, talk to me. We've only got a very brief period of time, so talk to me about winter grazing. It's just about upon us.
Okay, so winter grazing has always been an issue, and especially so in the Southland, where we've seen in the past some pretty awful pictures of cows up to their hocks and mud and that sort of thing, which is not good.
Mm.
The MPI, the Ministry for Primary Industries, is now going out there in the field and saying, okay, let's sort this out, guys. There's protocols around this now, and we don't want to see this sort of thing happening, because every time a picture like that is taken, it gets overseas in 5 minutes flat.
Yep.
It doesn't do the image of New Zealand any good. And last year I see that a farmer was prosecuted and fined nearly $50,000 for allowing that to happen. So there is some proactive things taking place. Winter grazing is not the wrong thing, but it has to be done in the right place, I think is the argument. And there are some rules, and there's some suggestions and some plans, some ability to say this is fine here, do it here, but don't do it there, it'll be okay. So we are seeing that happening. It's on the radar now. It's a few months off, but it's there. It's something that to be thought about. Yeah.
So is this based on the animal welfare?
It is. It's animal welfare as well. Yeah. It's
great.
Clean, yeah.
Okay. We certainly want our animals to be
treated
with respect.
Right.
Talk to me about Arawhenua to finish off.
So Arawhenua, the presentation of the trophy for the top Māori sheep and beef farm is in a few weeks' time in Palmerston North, and also the presentation for the young Māori, Arawhenua young Māori farmer for sheep and beef, and that's going to be a big evening. We are looking at about 800 people there for that function, which is not our biggest by any stretch of the imagination. We've been up to 1,000, but that's going to be held in Palmy. So there's a lot of work going on around that now, and I think everyone's quite excited about that. We've got two great finalists. And one of the other interesting things I just picked up was that one of the farms is out at Mahia Peninsula. It's Oanui Station, owned by the proprietors of Tauapata Incorporation. But the person who is running the launch pad for Rocket Lab, his parents actually were born in Mahia.
Oh.
So here is the son come back. Mahia's high-flying engineer. He's now the head of that operation at Mahia. And it's so wonderful that this young guy, great picture of him here, in front of the Rocket Lab station there at the background, he is now managing the launches from that station. So there's a lovely story in that. I think that was... Both farms are beautiful. I've been to both of them. I went to Mahia and up to north of Whangarei. And we've got two great finalists, and we've got three exciting young people turning up for the position of the Young Māori Farmer of the Year too. So we've got an exciting time coming up. We're swinging into that now, getting everything finalised, and so I think it's the first Friday in June, Palmy is our place to go.
It's a place to go.
Be a great place. It'll be a great night, and it always is. But I just cannot get away from seeing how wonderful some of these young people are, what they do, and here's this kid, got all these degrees and astro whatever it is. I can't even pronounce them, let alone spell them. but now he's running the launch pad on the plate on the very land that his parents were born on.
Isn't that fantastic?
It's wonderful. It's
what a great story.
Yeah.
Well, you can see that in Rural News if we want to get your copy of Rural News, or
go online, have a look. Just Google Rural News Group, and then that'll take you to our front page, and you can go and have a look, and you can see the pictures there of all these Māori farms there. The stories are there. All I've been talking about today, all there. The Winston pictures are there. All that stuff is there. So have a look, and you can read all about it.
Go and check it out. Thanks so much for coming in.
Great to be here.
This program was made with assistance from New Zealand On Air for radio broadcast and through the accessmedia.org.nz website. Thank you, New Zealand On Air.